Let's move on then. Let's look at our let's look at the work of Ron Gorchov and Holly Applebaum, recipient announced today of the Rome Prize, and Douglas Florian. So Lance, three abstract artists, three colorists, three artists for whom texture and shape and gesture all coalesce. I find them to be, or not, I find them to be three rather superb artists. I'd be hard pressed to say, to nominate the one of the three to put forward as the one that gave me the most pleasure. Do you have a similar dilemma?
No, not really. I think of the three, Gorchov is the most compelling. I'm still not convinced by them. I don't think that they achieve a certain kind of gestalt. And I think that I think they're compelling in that they brought me back to them. They're concave and convex at the same time. They remind me of shields and of a number of other kinds of things, relics. And but you know, the staples are left. The fabrication is made clear. And I think that the precedent here is somebody like Jean Arp, who creates abstract forms that actually twist in the plane. They feel alive. They suggest many different kinds of things. And I think that Gorchov kind of pares it all down to a point that he kind of sterilizes these forms that could be very organic and very exciting. I mean, with somebody like Arp, you get a torso and a piece of fruit, and it's erotic, and it's also like a snake, and then it's like, you know, all of these different things with just a single flat form. And then it twists in the plane and does all this. And I think that some of these forms of Gorchov's for me feel a little canned, like it's something that he's doing over and over again. And the titles for me, to me, kind of had nothing to do with, they didn't take me, I think of titles, especially with something like this, and Arp is, you know, it should be like little poems that give you a place to begin with a painting. And for him, he's, you know, one is called Diana, another one is called whatever, Artemis, another one is called, you know, Don't Touch Me, referring to the
Molly Maitandre.
Yeah. And of Christ and Mary Magdalene. And yet, you know, it reminds me, I was looking at the paintings, and I hope I don't offend anyone, but I do think that they're charming to a degree, and I do think the color is rich to a degree. I just don't think they really come together. But I was reminded of a painting professor I had in graduate school who was talking about Barnett Newman's Passions of the Cross, the Passion. Mm-hmm. And the Stations of the Cross. He said, for what that series has to do, and I like Barnett Newman, but he said, for what that series has to do with the Stations of the Cross, that series might as well be called Two Dogs Fucking. And I think that there's a place in here where for me, the titles become too highfalutin. And they also aren't specific enough. So they close the works down for me instead of opening them up. Because it's like, well, that's Diana, but in what way is it Diana? How is it Diana? How are you exploring Diana? How are you exploring this? You know, putting two forms there doesn't tell me anything really more about Diana, in a sense. It feels applied. But I did think he was the most compelling. The other...
Okay. So, so well, let's hold back, because obviously Applebaum and Florian are in for a treat. But let's deal with some of the issues that Lance is raising in relation to Gorchov. Maddie, for me, the comparison with Arp isn't really very helpful, because with Arp, each piece is a very specific shape, and it is as much sculpture.
Right, but don't we want specificity in painting?
And it is as much, with Arp, it's as much a sculpture as it is a painting. With Gorchov has a way of presenting his painting. Gorchov paints on a Gorchov surface rather than the ubiquitous given uncontested stretched rectangle on a frame. But that's, you kind of get used to that. To my eye, you enjoy that and you benefit from that, but you don't have to rethink the Gorchov concave convex saddle form each time any more than you would if you're looking at Rothko, say, ah, interesting, he's stretched canvas on a rectangular frame this time. Well, he does every time. So this is just Gorchov's way of doing business.
Yeah, but and you still have to convince that it's a necessity. You know, the rectangle is something we've inherited. You know, there's a tradition there. And so if you're going to reinvent the tradition, then convince me that there was a need to do it every time.
Isn't it better to take the opposite view? If you're going to use that same boring old tradition, at least convince me that there's a reason to do it.
Well, I'm saying, but the rectangle, I mean, you know, it worked for Titian, you know, worked for Mondrian. It's like, there is something there, you know.
There's something to experimentalism for its own sake, too.
There's something
to experimentalism for its own sake. This is a thing that he's invented.
I disagree. I mean, not for its own sake.
I'd take it before tradition for its own sake. If we're going there,
when you accept tradition, then you explore the tradition and you understand, and then you rework the tradition. You extend the tradition. When you start over, as he's doing, with a form that is suddenly coming out of left field, and you don't convince us that it was it's a necessary form, that it means something to Diana, that it also means to this painting, you know, like
why don't we just leave Diana? I mean, you know,
the titles.
So if they were all untitled, they don't matter.
Titles are when.
Well, so is he being ironic?
It doesn't matter. Just think he's a bad titler. You can be a great painter.
Forget titles.
You know, listen, Clement Greenberg said Jackson Pollock was terrible at titles. You know, he may have been right, but you know, you look at the painting and you see it for what it is.
Listen, Jackson Pollock was painting Moby Dick. And James Johnson Sweeney came to visit. He looked at the painting. He walked out. They had a nice studio visit. As he was leaving, he says, great painting, but call it Pacify. And it's called Pacify. And now, does that close it down? Is it about Pacify? Does it do something with Pacify? Forget Pacify. Go and read Moby Dick. It's a painting. I mean, Tom Noskowski calls all of his works untitled brackets, 201-6. I mean, does that close it down? Does that open it up?
There's a tradition of using the word untitled too.
Yes,
that's a tradition which is
tired and is a convention and is inconvenient. And he's got the tradition of saying, "Oh, I'll call it Diana. I'll call it Nolly Me Tangere."
But I think if they don't mean anything, if we're supposed to ignore them, then I think it's kind of you're not being very conscious of your viewer. You're kind of being, if they don't matter, and I'm not putting this in his mind, and you know, I'm not saying this was his intention, but if they don't matter, then you're giving us two different ways to think about this.
I was simply trying to get us off course.
Unless his point is these titles are so ridiculous, obviously they don't matter.
I would suggest if the titles work for you, I'm glad I gave you a good title. And if they don't, at least you've got an easier way to remember the painting than a number sequence that you'll never remember. So it's a win-win situation with these titles. And it's a red herring as well.
They could be called 2 feet on a scale, on a bathroom scale. Mm-hmm. You know, because to me that's the first thing I think of when I see all of them. 2 feet on a bathroom scale.
Okay, but calling it Diana, so it's Diana's 2 feet on a bottom scale. It didn't say it's the goddess of chastity. It just said it's someone called Diana, and Diana has 2 feet. Even the goddess of chastity has 2 feet. So I mean, fine. It doesn't actually close it down for your metaphor, Maddie. What do the titles mean to you, and is it important or not? Or tell us your take on Gorchov.
Yeah, I didn't really care about the titles. I didn't read the titles until I had gone through and looked at all of the work.
I only heard the titles this evening. I didn't even look at all.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, I didn't look at the titles either, I have to admit.
I just saw the kind of
abstract painter for whom the titles are just there to give a convenient hook to be able to refer to the painting to. It never occurred to me to think that he would have an interesting, you know, or revelatory title. I just thought I was supposed to look at the paintings like that, without a caption.
How about the saddle form, the Gorchov support? Is it incumbent on Gorchov to re-argue with each painting he does the Gorchov support, or can he have us just take his support as his convention?
I think that that's what he's decided to do. I think that the works are very much about balance and tension as creating balance or enforcing balance. I think that the surface of the work, the way that the paint is thinly applied, the way that it's flattened and the shapes don't have a lot of movement, it's very much about the colors on the canvas. And then you have, I don't think that they are sculptures, but you have the sculptural form that is the canvas. Or not the canvas, the wood, yeah.
The thing.
By the way, what about there were the two pieces that were different, that there were these kind of stacked canvases, which I had not... Yes. I've seen this work before, but I had not seen...
Well, they relate to those walk-through gates that he's done in the past.
Okay, yeah. See, I don't know them, but I actually like those better than the more familiar saddle-like ones because... well, first of all, I think somehow I prefer him as a kind of quasi-monochrome painter without the forms floating in it, which maybe like Lance, I don't find entirely compelling as forms. And somehow in those pieces there was a real sense of a kind of biological growth, as if a plant that, you know, develops the next sort of ring or whatever, and it added something to the sort of progression of the color somehow, to have this sort of visual biological metaphor.
Did the stacks work for you better than the saddles?
Well, Barry's convincing me more about them just hearing him talk about them. They weren't the things that in the show that I wasn't taken to them. You know, I was more interested in the singular objectness of the other things, the other paintings, the saddle forms. For me, their duration wasn't, it seemed to begin and end abruptly. And for the scale, there's something wrong about the scale to me. For their, like, maybe they should have been twice as tall or something. I didn't think that they worked that well coloristically. But I do agree with you that there is something more to, there's more integrity maybe to the forms in relationship to the colors, and, you know, as a larger idea. Of what is it a sculpture? Is it a painting? You know, it does suggest a kind of progression of growth or something. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of Brancusi endless column idea or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I would put up a defense with Gorchov for the two forms in echelon or in dialogue or in opposition or dancing on the concave convex saddle form. My experience of the Gorchov show, I mean, I've been a big fan for years and enjoyed seeing the show, but my Gorchov appreciation turned a big corner, actually, when I went to see his show with a friend, and I said, okay, well, let's look at Gottlieb first. Gottlieb, a canonical, but really, history has kind of decided, second-tier canonical, first-generation abstract expressionist, and... an artist for whom the problem of formula is crucial. I mean, with Gottlieb, it's the splatter underneath and the one or two orbs above and the big ground.
My old friend Norman Bloom, whenever Gottlieb's name came, would say, moon over Miami.
Right, okay. So to me, that's why Gottlieb is almost the paradigm of the problematic abstract expressionist. You see why it went on. And so with Gorchov, he's a kind of historical refugee in a way, because he's a grand old man now, but he got going very, very young and was actually in sensibility and in association, even though his career, if you look at his career, it feels like a career that sort of really got going in the 70s, 80s. Actually, as a person, he was there and sort of supping at the table with the first generation Abexes, and his sensibility is rather more with theirs. And so I look at his work and say, okay, yes, like those first generation abstract expressionists, he's an artist who has to have his way of doing business, Rothko's way of doing business is all the more compelling than Gottlieb's. But then there's Gorchov. And yet, this is an artist who could only be doing this now. And that seemed to me a revelation, that your sensibility is in the 40s and 50s, but what you actually achieve could only be achieved now. And because you couldn't paint with with many of the elements that are in Gorchov then, but you can, but he does now. And it seemed to me that I accepted his saddle form. Each time it rewarded me by doing things spatially with the supporting image, and each and every image was completely unique in itself, unlike the Gottlieb. I've totally convinced you all. You can't dare argue.
We're dumbfounded that you find them so unique. No, I mean, they... I don't see how you could find the images unique. I could say the paintings could be unique, but the images aren't, if you catch my distinction. As images, they all seem variations on one theme. He does a lot of different things with this theme because he can do a lot of different things with paint, with color, they're unique only in the same sense that each Gottlieb is unique.
Right. Sorry, not later. I think it's because I think of the format, for instance, as being like a sonnet. So you know, no one says, oh, that's Shakespeare. You know, every single one is 14 lines long, and each line has this number of pentameters in it. No, I mean, iambic pentameters. No, I mean, it's a form. And it's, I mean, with Shakespeare's, that's an inherited form. So I think you can be very expressive within a very tight range of formal devices. And I think some of those forms are mirror images. Some of them are in a kind of 69-type relationship. Some of them are in antagonism. Some of them are dancing. Some of them are static. So, I mean, I think there's a whole range of expressive possibilities.
For me, what you're applying to them doesn't bear itself out in the forms themselves. Yes, they look like they could be dancing or they could be doing this, but in terms of being living forms, I mean, actually twisting in the plane or having a dynamic of life, I find that there were occasional instances in that show where along one edge you felt a tension in the color, right, against the form, those would alert you to the fact that it wasn't happening in many other places for me. And so for me, you know, I demand that if it's going to dance, then you make the forms dance. You give them life. And so to me, they're a little bit DOA. I mean, they're attractive, they're charming, but in terms of being vital, living forms in a painting, they're kind of fey. They're kind of just there. And again, they deny you the metaphors that they suggest because they're not alive. Coloristically, they're interesting, but the color, you know, it doesn't have a real formal integrity for me. You know, that's what I demand from it. I mean, that's, you know, when I come to that, I'm saying, give me what art gives me, or give me what, you know, any painter gives me. Living, breathing, you know, twisting, moving, dynamic, mm-hmm, life. Anyway, so that's my...
Yeah, I think we're hitting, it's very well put, of course, but we're hitting a subjective terrain where...
I don't think it's subjective. I think it's a tradition that you learn, and it's the tradition of abstraction, which gets us to the next painter.
Yes.
Who, you know, basically is pissing on the tradition, I think. It's just kind of like, I think there's a whole tradition out there now of, who did the article in Art in America recently?
Raphael Rubinstein.
Yeah, Raphael Rubinstein. About
provisional.
Exactly, about provisional abstract. It's like one eye closed painting, you know? It's like, whatever. You know, and you know what? If I don't work hard, you don't have to work hard either. Just put it on the wall. It's all decorative. Who gives a shit? And I think that, for me, there's very little integrity. But
which one are you talking
walls.
About?
Well, he mentioned walls, so I think he must have meant Florian.
Yeah, I'm talking about Florian now. Anyway, but I think that there's a...
When you mentioned pissing, I thought of the floor, but no,
yeah,
I mentioned
exactly.
That. Right. Okay. Okay, let's move on to Florian. But let's also say, however, that No, it's saying, oh, it's not subjective because there's a tradition and a received language, but each artist has to reinvent that tradition, and artists are entitled to have very different agendas.
Extend the tradition, don't reinvent it.
To say that because ARP are compelling organic shapes, if you have anything that reminds me of ARP, you have to be a compelling and organic shape, says, well, maybe actually Gorchov's are more compelling for kind of being maybe a bit subdued, and a bit, and maybe in fact the kind of ideographic quality in them carries a weight, more weight, a weight that would have been kind of cliched if they'd been organic. So organic
isn't... If a painting is dead, it's cliché?
No, I'm saying...
I mean, if a form is dead?
No, we're not about dead. We're saying you've put forward organic as being the yardstick.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm just saying that he's coming out of that tradition. He's referring to...
He's
unaware of it. He may be unaware of
it. He's not unaware of anything, but the tradition is so rich that you don't have to be indebted to ARP to use a shaped canvas. Why not be indebted to Ellsworth Kelly?
And Ellsworth Kelly is another person to bring up, because Ellsworth Kelly's forms are alive. They have tension. They have life. And Gorchov's forms, whether it's by choice or not, do not have that kind of, what I want, which is,
Maddie, I would say that they by choice are deliberately not being big, strong, high energy, emphatic, high chroma forms, but they have a kind of insouciance, a kind of holding back, a kind of reticence, a kind of dullness of color in a sort of jolly laid kind of way that makes them rather interesting. If you look at, say, Jack Bush's paintings that were on show recently, they also have that very dusty, murky kind of color quality going on, and that made them distinct and more interesting.
I thought that he was playing with the dusty, murky color quality up against the hyper-pigmented kind of poppy color. I thought that work was so beautiful with it was like a dusty lilac, and then the poppy-colored forms. Yeah. Was that the tension you were kind of talking about with the...
Yeah.
I saw that one as being alive, maybe more than the other ones. But that's true. It wasn't something that you would think that the forms lands are gimmicky, maybe.
No, it's not. I just think that they're not really embracing what they're coming out of. I don't think that they're knowledgeable enough. I don't think that they have enough integrity of what a form like that is suggestive of many things and yet nothing specific, which is... That's why I'm bringing up ARP, where you're kept in a transition, a metaphoric transition, but the metaphors have to be brought to bear. They have to, you have to transfer that weight. You have to move it. You have to be very clear about your ambiguity, about what you're holding me between. And that's why I would say ARP is a master of that kind of, and that he is coming out of that. He's, like it or not, he's coming out of that tradition by doing forms that ARP did. You can't have it both ways. If you're going to refer back to that, then you are treading in that on that ground.
Honestly, and even though I think I'm not so far away from you in
your assessment of Gorchov,
my feeling about Gorchov's paintings, and in a way, as you're going, it's funny because as you're going along, you're kind of, you start out saying, well, I don't like any of these three painters so much, but he's the one that's the most interesting. But, as you go on, you're kind of running him further and further down, as if he wasn't really interesting at all. I think he is pretty interesting, even though it doesn't quite do it for me, but it just amazes me to hear you sitting here, and talking about, dare I say it, kind of an old guy who's been painting and painting and painting for years and years and years, and probably, knows a very great deal about painting and its history, and talking as if you're kind of his teacher, saying, well, you have to learn this and you have to learn that. And, he's figured out for himself, he's learned it, and he's figured out for himself what he thinks he does and doesn't need to use anymore. It's not on that level, whatever the objection is, it's not on the level of you know, you've either got to do this or you, you know, you don't pass the course. You know, it's not, it's just not like that.
I would defend Lance's right to be as bloody minded as he likes, though, Barry. My problem with Lance is not that he's being mean to Sam, let's be gentle to Ron because he's in his
I never said let's be gentle, but I'm just saying, you know, don't think that you know more than him. Well, you know different things than him.
I was trained
undoubtedly.
As a painter.
We all know different things.
And so I learned a certain language, and then, you know, I don't want to start excusing painters, you know, because they don't know the language.
But you learned painting from a guy who doesn't even understand Barnett Newman.
I actually studied abstraction with descendants of Mondrian. But beyond that, that's not really the issue. The issue is that when you come, for me, when I come to a work of art, and if it's not, you know, I compare it. I'm making aesthetic judgments. I'm making comparisons. I'm saying, what do I get? What does this remind me of? Well, it reminds me of art. Well, what is it not giving me? Or what is it giving me?
It's not giving me up. Of course, it's not giving you up. Because it's not up. But this is the problem. Because
art is
not a language.
Yes, it is.
Art is language, and then artists speak one of dozens and dozens of languages.
Form is a language.
If you say, look, I've studied English literature, I'm reading Racine, he's sort of reminding me of Shakespeare, he's not giving it to me, there's too many rhymes, this is a... You can, of course, deconstruct Racine for not being
I'm talking about gibberish coming out versus something you understand.
No, but Racine and Shakespeare are neither of them gibberish.
They're both
epigenes of classical forms.
They have different...
One is French and one is English.
Okay, but they have different sensibilities, okay? But they're both speaking a language that can be understood. They're using words that we understand.
But when you reduce...
That's the language.
Unless you're bilingual, one of them you're going to read in translation.
Well,
and then, even if you were bilingual, you get into a different spirit when you listen to and think and read French than with English. But I'm glad you're not arguing with that, because there's no point bringing ARP to Gorchov simply because Gorchov-shaped canvases make you think of ARP.
No, I'm talking about the forms he's putting on them that are ARP forms.
They are forms that could remind you of ARP, but they could also remind you of hieroglyphs.
Therefore,
why not go to Egypt and then leave out ARP?
Well, they don't. No, I don't know. I wouldn't call them hieroglyphs. That's a different language too. But they're both abstract, at least. But here's the difference, okay? With hieroglyphs and ARP, there's a connection where they're using the plane as a field that is malleable, where they're putting forms in that field and getting the plane to become elastic, to use Hoffman's term, push-pull, to keep the plane and there's an organic integration of the plane with the forms that are embedded in it. And the ancient Egyptians did that, as did ARP. And what I'm saying is that you've got Gorchov, who's working out of that tradition that goes all the way back to ancient Egypt. Thank you for bringing it up. But he is not creating the kind of tension in the plane that ARP and the Egyptians do. And so for me, he's not speaking the language that he has adopted as well as he could be. So, you know, call it ancient, you know, go to ancient Egypt or go to, you know, he's not exploring that particular way, that tradition, as well as I would like. That's all. As I said, I still think the paintings are... I thought they were charming. I thought there was they were certainly compelling in certain ways. I thought the color was kind of Pompeian. I mean, there are things about them that I thought were somewhat gorgeous. It's just, I'm just going to an extreme here in terms of talking about what I would like more of.
Fair enough. Douglas Florian, we've had Lance's take on Douglas Florian. Is that something you would accept, Maddie, or would you like to make a case for Douglas Florian?
What was your take? I'm sorry.
I don't remember. Something
pissing
urination.
And something yeah. fluid.
No, I said they're kind of... it's nonchalant.
He saw them as being extreme nonchalant. I haven't worked hard. You don't have to work hard.
I've found that he obviously did work hard on some of them, right?
Maybe, you know, long, but maybe not hard.
My point is,
who cares how long it took?
Right. My point is, the ones that did look more worked, the ones that were more layered, the ones that where parts were rubbed away, I thought were more interesting, just simply visually interesting, than the sort of more figurative, there were some skeletal sort of and some heart shapes that I just didn't care about at all, and I found to be incredibly decorative and fine to look at, but not interesting.
Barry?
It's funny because in this case, I'm really amazed that that Lance could say that he seems kind of offhand and to be nonchalant about it's
provisional.
Yeah, I mean, I had the exact opposite view. If I would, you know, I would start my critique from wondering why he felt he had to be so earnest in about these things that didn't necessarily need to be as earnest as they were made to feel, I thought. So I'm actually a little puzzled that we could have such opposite, you know, sense of the sensibility that was put into these paintings. And it makes me wonder, in a funny way, whether maybe the paintings aren't something different than what either of us thought. And I wish I could go back there and check it out again. You know, to me, it seemed that... I mean, I like the paintings fairly well. I wished it would had been kind of a more edited show. But if I kind of looked at the ones that I found the most interesting, I liked the way he kind of tried to integrate shape with surface. I guess that's essentially how I would put it. You know, figure ground, you could say in a different way. The funny thing about it is how it seemed to me that every painting had some bright red in it, and with some exceptions, usually it was bright red that was kind of seeping up from kind of the background.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that was kind of his sort of go-to device to sort of make the ground become the most forefronted thing in the painting and to try and unify things. And I kind of wished he hadn't resorted to that so
frequently.
I
actually found myself wishing, but for similar reasons, the opposite of what you wished for. I wish the show was less edited because I find him a very satisfying but small kind of artist. He is, if Gorchov is a full meal, Florian is sweets, they're candy. And I think what he does gorgeously. He's an artist who comes out of, he has his day job, so to speak, is making children's books. And if we saw, as in previous shows, one with Florian, if we've seen a great many more and works on paper, they really sparkle and they're just, you just want more and more. They are like candy. They're sweet, they're not very good for you, and you don't really get more from one than the other. It's not actually an artist that one benefits enormously by going around saying this one is more interesting than that one. There almost are a continuity, and that does identify him as not a major artist, but I feel there's a lot of space in our culture for wonderful minor artists, as well as, you know, but it does amaze me to misread, as I feel these are, I mean, this is open to debate and conjecture, but it's extraordinary when you consider, you've mentioned Tuttle already, who's a wonderful artist, when you consider the range of kinds of provisionalism, informality, nonchalance that exists within abstract art. You think of somebody like sort of Joe Fyfe or James Hyde, or you think about the French support surface artists, when you think about all those Brooklyn people, Chris Martin, all that. There's your provisional painting. This, as I agree with Barry, this is pretty earnest and worked up and thought through and felt and intuited art. So it's very, very... I mean, everyone's entitled to not like them. Everyone's entitled to be dismissive of them. But I think just if we're interested in the notion of provisional painting, hate it, love it or hate it, this just isn't provisional painting. But would you insist that it is? I mean, is it?
I found that there were things to like within the paintings, but generally for me, they were not composed. I think it was very rare that the scale and what went on inside the scale, the rectangle, was really made sense. To me, they often kind of fell into a decorative. Into that realm. I feel like the forms are often meandering within, or that the scale, that the painting could be bigger or smaller, and it kind of wouldn't really make a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then that's, you know, what do you say? You know, if it doesn't matter if it's longer or shorter or whatever.
Right.
You know,
bigger right.
or small, you know.
Then what?
Well, then that makes if it doesn't matter, then why is it? And then it becomes provisional in a sense. I mean, yeah, it's not as...
I found that each one set its own scale, its own tempo, its own mood. I didn't think any of them fail in themselves to have a definable texture, mood, orientation, but... So therefore, for me, provisional painting is very much a kind of painting that you feel was yanked out the studio before it was finished. It didn't. It could have carried on working. It could have had. It's playing with lessness.
Maybe you shouldn't make too much of this provisional painting idea. In a sense, that's just another way to rearticulate the recurrent issue since Manet, you know, about when and whether a painting is finished. And
yes. It sounds
Manet
like
was being kind of flippant too, in a way, right? I mean, he was a little bit flippant as a painter. You know, probably this tradition begins, provisional painting probably begins with Manet. Mm-hmm. You know, he was probably the best provisional painter mm-hmm. who ever lived, but yeah, that kind of what, you know, like, you know, I'm going to do it and not do it, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to upset you, which he did. He upset a lot of people.
Well, look, Jackson Pollock said, was asked, how do you know when a painting is finished? And he said, how do you know when you finished having sex? Yeah. So,
That's
good enough. Well,
Joan Snyder said the same thing. You know, so.
Well, but with Pollock, it's incredibly apt.
Orgasmically
apt.
Well, I kind of want that from a painting. I want an orgasm. You know, I want life. I mean, that's what an orgasm is, right? It's the beginning of life, right?
Well, it's the little death, I was told.
Or the little death, right. Well, something's got to give every time.
Are you coming or are you going? As the Japanese write or are we right about orgasms?
But I think this idea of provisional painting is something that was, oh, if only he'd worked on it 7 more minutes or something. You know, I think you can work on a painting or on anything for, you know, 40 years, and it could still be provisional. You know, it doesn't matter how worked up it is or how much we feel you've been, at the grindstone every day, in there, sanding it down and starting over, you know.
Good
for
you.
No brownie
points,
you know,
yes.
But,
yes.
You know, then, you know, does it float? You know,
right.
does it work?
Right.
Who cares how long it took? Or what's being referred to? Because provisionalism is something you refer to, too.
Maddie, Polly, can we ignore the issue of... It's an interesting, very, very interesting issue to me, the issue of effort. Of course, I think we'd all agree it's ridiculous to award brownie points for effort or to slap people on the wrist for having painted a masterpiece too quickly. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the artist does her work in her studio or wherever, and we get to look at it. But with Applebaum, there is... there is a kind of ethic of accumulation, if you mm-hmm. like. How do you relate to the way the thing has been made and the sense of effort in the way the thing has been made in relation to the experience you get from it?
As a woman?
As a woman, as a young person, as a, no stereotyping, no essentialism permitted on this panel. As a fully equal member of our panel, how do you feel?
I found the two shows to be incredibly different, obviously. I thought that the I couldn't tell if the glitter, I forget what it was called now, not the Flatland.
Flatland.
That's no.
Flatterland. Flatterland is the one on the floor.
Oh, it is? Okay.
And the table's okay. A Flatland.
I couldn't tell if Flatland was a joke. I think it was kind of a joke, right? It was a joke about craft and craft, I found. Mm. It was also a joke about composition. They were very interested in the literature about the material and the fact that the material could have, that kind of glittery material could have been read as minerals or, you know, mica or drugs or glitter. But I thought it was, you know, I wasn't particularly interested in the forms that she created to, those forms that she rolled out that she put the glitter on, those sort of plasticky.
Kind of platter things,
yeah. I didn't care much for those.
Well, it was the Hansel and Gretel garden gallery, wasn't it? So it made me think of cake and things.
Yeah. I mean, it was very delicious.
Right. Gave me indigestion. I want to go back to the floor piece, which I think
the floor
was the
piece
real,
was beautiful.
Right? So let's talk about the floor piece.
I thought, all right, so we're not doing the glitter piece. I thought the floor piece was beautiful. I thought that the floor piece, it was a commentary on issues of women's work and craft, and it was incredibly evocative, obviously, in a way that the glitter was not, and maybe was trying to be. Mm. But I thought it was a beautiful work. It was, you know, obviously evocative of tie-dye and quilting. And I think from her other work, it just seemed very her. And I was telling a friend today, it seemed very Brooklyn Museum.
Oh.
It was very...
Define that for us.
Well, it was just very Elizabeth A. Sackler Center for Feminist Art.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And not in any sort of bad way, but it uh-huh. seemed like it was very
so it's
invested.
The dinner party. This is the rug to go right, with the dinner party.
Right. For example.
Okay.
For example.
Yikes.
I don't hate the dinner party.
I mean, but no. That's a take. That's fascinating. That's why one has this panel, to hear something one would never have dreamt of oneself, and then bounce it around. Barry, do you buy that line on Apfelbaum?
The Elizabeth Sackler Center line, that line?
Yes.
Yes and no. In the sense that I think that is somehow... I think that's very much part of the background of the work.
Mm.
On the other hand, I think, in a way, it's like the saddle form for...
Gorchov.
It's, you know... Polly has been working with that for so long now, and she's been developing it, and you know, trying to kind of pull out all the possible variations on it for so long that, in a way, I kind of take that background as kind of read, and then I just kind of go on to look at it in a way, maybe in a much more formalist way, just in terms of, well, how is she actually composing with these pieces this time, and how is she, in this case, incorporating the squares cut into the form by the columns, and mm-hmm. the way she's playing with kind of the there's so many kind of linear forms that kind of go from the edges toward, you know, the various centers of the piece versus areas that are more kind of not vectorial, mm-hmm. And I just thought she kind of handled all that, and there's a lot of that, you know, just really in a kind of beautiful way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you transported by this magic carpet?
I wasn't really engaged with it. You know, I got it as a kind of overall thing, and we're talking about the floor work.
Yes.
You know, it was a kind of a... I think there was a little tension between the chaotic and the structure, you know, the chaos and structure. There was something about that, a kind of Big Bang quality to it. But I wasn't... I felt like there was a lot of effort put into it with maybe, you know, it became a kind of art about minutia that where the payoff wasn't as large, perhaps, as the amount of, you know, all the detail, all the little touching, all the, anyway. But, you know, it's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. It doesn't hurt anyone.
Yeah. It takes up a lot of space.
Yeah. But, you know, I saw people touching it when I was in there.
Oh, really?
Tut-tut.
Yeah, they were touching it, yeah. Mm. And saying, I just can't not touch it. Okay.
Okay.
You know, like, it's a velvet thing. I think it's a crushed velvet thing.
Yeah.
You know?
I can't not kick you in the ass and give them a kick in the ass. To me, they're like Pollock meets Klimt. And
how long did it take you to think of it?
I just thought about it at this moment. I just thought about it this moment. And those are two painters I like, but I never would have thought of putting them together. And therefore, I give her kudos for having me put Klimt and Pollock together. All overness, splatter, intensity, decoration, the meaning of decoration, etc.
All overness, but less.
It's not the compelling gestalt of a Jackson Pollock, that is true.
That it's less compelling for that reason, but it's not seeking to be.
It's not less compelling in itself, but it doesn't make a unified, energy made visible gestalt its sine qua non. That's
right.
True. But I liked her. I like it. And I hope she has a good time in Rome. Ladies and gentlemen, do you have any comments on the three shows we've been debating here? We've been debating it rather vehemently, and I see rather a lot of rather distinguished abstract painters in the audience. There may be some very distinguished photographers and video makers in the audience that I'm too ignorant to know by face, but I do see quite a lot of... I see some artists who've actually been discussed on this panel. I've seen some critics who've been on this panel who are abstract painters, so I do hope we do get some feedback from you. Marshall.
David, I know you hate it when the audience kicks a question back to the panel, but in this case, I just can't help myself.
Go for it.
Lance.
One rule, though, is that a question you put is a question to all of us.
Okay, all of you.
We're a Politburo. We answer sort of one.
But it might be clear who this is directed toward. Are there any living artists that you actually do like?
Oh, many, yeah. Yes.
All right, are there any living abstract painters who would help us see the weakness of Florian and Gottschalk, for instance?
Well, I think Ellsworth Kelly is a master. I think Joan Snyder is pretty far up there. I mean, they're two very different sensibilities, but still, as far as I'm concerned, working out of, you know, very, very different sensibilities, working out of the same tradition. Maybe not well, but, yeah.
Okay. Yes, Carol, but wait for the mic, if you would, behind you.
After seeing the Florian show, we went to see Tom Noskowski. And as far as I'm concerned, Tom Noskowski is trying to do everything that a lot of painters are trying to do, but doing it on a much higher level. He really manages to bring it all together. And I think he's one who's contemporary, so we could look at him in that light.
Yeah, again, I think it's a sort of apples and oranges problem, though. I mean, Noskowski has an agenda that is completely discreet from Florian, and to simply say, oh, but they're both abstract and they're both painters. And yes, okay, we can have a third agenda, our own, and then say Noskowski is closer to me than Florian in my agenda. But I feel that I have to, when I look at art, I need to balance what I need and want from it with an intelligent approximation or sense of the built-in intentionality of that work, and it seems to me that Douglas Florian and Thomas Noskowski, besides being nice guys who paint and are alive at the moment, really just not moving in the same direction. So I wouldn't expect them to arrive at the same destination.
David, can you think of someone who is sort of in the same game as Florian, and could you compare them as more or less successful in what they're trying to achieve?
That That is a very valid, fair, and decent question. And I'm but I can't. I do strongly sense that there are quite probably some people who would fit that bill. I'll probably remember it over dinner or in the middle of the night. Could you think of somebody who's in very much the same territory as Florian then?
It's funny because it's
past
not,
as well as present.
It's not that I think he's not such a unique project. It does seem to me that I see periodically other painters around that are kind of aiming at similar things. It's hard to really pinpoint one, but somehow I want to say that he's and I don't know if he where he went to school or if he went to art school or what his background is, but when I look at it, I think it's kind of a New York studio school.
No.
I used to know a bunch of those people. Some of them I think would have been aiming in this kind of direction.
I don't 80s. actually. Funny enough, you mentioned Ellsworth Kelly, Lance. If you look at that red form and then look at Kelly's work he did in Paris in the late 40s, actually, this Florian I think has a very old-fashioned sensibility, and that actually a lot of Latin American artists of the 50s and 40s and 50s. Where this work would have looked very at home, so I think it's actually also a contemporary painter like who I think Florian is a bit better than is Caio Fonseca. So I think there are definitely quite a lot of people who make. I mean, with Noskowski, he's a prolific artist, but every single one of them. You look at it, immediately know it's a Noskowski. It's in Noskowski's handwriting, Noskowski's language, Noskowski's range of interests. But each and every one of them, if you can disagree with me on Gorchov, but most people who like Noskowski would agree with me on Noskowski, each one of them is absolutely, oh, that is that piece, that's that one. Yes, it relates to that other one, but that is that one. With Fonseca and with Florian, you're basically, with each painting, and this is where I think Lance has a good point about arbitrary cutoff. With each painting, it's like a slice of a very big pie. And another slice would have given you, okay, a little bit less fruit, a little more pastry.
But it partly has to do with Fonseca's process, which is almost an Achilles heel.
Yes.
Because he, from what I understand, having been to a studio that he creates these forms and then, he puts down, a ground and then creates forms over them and to let the ground come through. And there's almost, I think there's, at a certain point, he can't reinvent it because he has to keep what, it's a process of addition that can, does not have subtraction or something. Anyway. But.
Yes. Absolutely wonderful, of course.
No, there are a few people who want to make comments. It's hard to kind of articulate this, but I'll try.
Can you literally articulate it? Because the mic is either not working
okay.
or the air conditioning is too loud. I can't hear you.
Is that better?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So talking about Gorchov, his work is in the territory of hybrid work, as is Pauly's. And I was trying to follow you on you panel, specifically on the left. The imagery also, I think, is wants to slip away from any sort of traditional or obvious strictures or associations. And so with Pauly's work, there's paint on the material, and then it's layered on the floor in the space and behaves more like sculpture, and the forms of Gorchov's come off the wall and flirt with you, but they never really come into your space. And the sort of atmospheric quality of the paint and the image on top of that kind of, I don't know, in my opinion, they meld perfectly. I don't ask a lot of those beans, I call them beans or pods or nose, eyeball, there's sort of these little moments. And so it's not really a it's not really a question that I have. It's more a comment about a curiosity about your ideas of hybridity in the work.
I didn't see the Apfelbaum as being particularly sculptural. Least of all just because it was flat. But is it because of the layered, the paint on the fabric that you were feeling like?
No, I'm actually talking, I was referring to the layering of the work itself. You know, the layers that eventually get built up. The fact that they're on the floor, like an André, but not.
Oh, like an André.
An André that you're not allowed to walk on.
Yeah.
I see them coming out of the tradition of collage, actually. That form, that work.
I see them as so much art that's in an interminable argument with minimal art, and an attempt to re-maximalize, but acknowledging and working through minimal art. So I think André is a good call. Yes. You do, because we're recording and we won't pick you up at all. Please, sorry. Thanks, Rose.
I just have to say I was a little bit shocked that someone said that they thought that Polly's work belonged in the Sackler Centre. Because, I mean, I find that quite a kind of strange thing to say, because the whole point of her showing her work in that gallery, in that context, I would have thought, was not to be restricted to that context. I find that I don't know, I was just kind of like really quite shocked by that comment
Okay.
I can't really express it anymore.
Yeah.
So. Shock is good. We want you to be awed as well, though. But,
I don't know, I mean, I didn't make the comment, so I maybe Maddie should interpose. But it did make sense to me to hear it said, and look, I mean, there's a very specific, women's tradition, if you want to call it a tradition. Maybe it's too young still to be called quite a tradition, but a lineage. It's a feminist one. It is, Linda Bengless with her works on the floor. It is an artist who was really important to a lot of people, who maybe a lot of people don't know or don't remember because she kind of disappeared, called Lauren Sold, who made work on the floor and influenced a lot of people in New York. And I think Polly is part of that. Doesn't mean that she's limited to that, but I think it must be part of her inspiration.
And also, I'm a little surprised if you're going off to Buffalo to study queerness as well, because it seems that don't know if I'm going off on a limb here, but like Mary Heilman, as well as being a feminist artist, there is a kind of gayness in Apfelbaum, and saying, oh, it's very Sackler Centre, almost sounds like it's saying, if gender and sexuality issues animate your work, you belong in that wing of a museum that dealt with that.
Right.
Why not
right.
put everything in a wing of a museum?
Right.
Do you want to defend that, or are you?
It's not what I meant.
No, of course.
No, I didn't mean it to be. Yeah.
But if you only restrict it to that, if you only put it in that place...
Then... Right, no, and I wouldn't restrict it to that, and I wouldn't just put it in that place. I don't think that that place is such a tiny box either. I think that to talk about feminist work in general and American women making feminist work is a far more broad category. It was a reference point more than literally a space and a restrictive box. So you think her work is queer in that?
It's just by introducing color. I don't think homosexual people have a monopoly on color. But I think that she was influenced by, funnily enough, we could have put her with Stan Douglas, because actually 70s disco and funk definitely informed her early chromatic sensibility.
Yeah.
And that was sort of bringing some, I believe, well, certainly...
That's going to take further
take us a long way
for me, but...
Yes.
I'm interested that you bring up Stan Douglas, because in a lot of the literature that talked about the work, they talked about disco as being this underground gay movement, and I didn't see that.
Well, there's a guy in a dog strap.
Well, that was the one... Okay, fine. All right. Because, so you saw ass cheeks. I don't think that that makes it gay per se. And I don't think that it was speaking to... Oh, and maybe the masculine woman.
Yes.
I thought that was I didn't find that to be particularly pertinent, and I didn't. It certainly was politically queer.
Right, right,
right.
Yeah, that's more. There was more in the press release than the work.
Right.
But great. Any further comments on the three abstract painters we've been thinking about? Otherwise, I'd say thank you very much, and see you all in September.